Happy Monday.
Good morning, everyone.
This is November 30th, 2020, and this is episode 127 of Transmission.
And it's also Kathleen's birthday.
Is it?
It is.
Happy birthday, Kathleen.
Well, happy birthday. And I'm Daniel Wolpert. I direct MICA, the Minnesota Institute of Contemplation and Healing.
I'm Mark Van Steenhoek. I direct the Center for Prophetic Imagination.
And so Gus recognized the cover photo, which I didn't.
I should explain that. This is a Shel Silverstein's The Giving Tree is maybe a beloved book to many children, but it's about this tree who has a loving relationship with a little boy. But as the little boy gets older, he takes the tree for granted and only shows up when he needs things. Kind of like a bad brother or uncle who comes to you only when you need stuff, money for alcohol or whatever. It keeps coming. And the giving tree's like, oh, finally, the little boy's come back and visited me. And then finally, though, you know, he asks for enough wood to build a house or whatever. And so by the end, the tree is a stump. And the little boy is now an old man. And he only comes back to sit on her, the tree. And she's like, oh, we're together again. So, like, this horrible example of lifelong codependency, like many children's stories that are really fucked up if you look at them, this is an example of codependency. And yes, I know a lot of you probably love it and want to defend it, but you shouldn't. And I think so. I believe Shel Silverstein knew what he was doing. And he was like, I'm going to tell this story that shows the toxicity of a relationship that goes one way. But then people are like, this is a good message for our children. Anyways,
yeah. Oh wow, it's also Susan's birthday.
Got a lot of birthdays today.
Happy birthday. Okay, and so Gus apparently is recommending there's an updated
version where the tree sets boundaries, and as a result generations have been able to enjoy the apples.
Okay, good.
Yeah, I've seen rewrites of this that are good, and but it's funny seeing people get really upset tweaking their childhood favorite.
Yeah. So it might be worthwhile just to define codependency briefly. So this is a term that originally came out of addiction work, specifically alcoholism work. And so what people began to observe is that alcoholics who were said to be dependent upon alcohol often had somebody in their life. Often had somebody in their life who was kind of attached to them, right? A spouse, you know, a partner, family member, and what people start to realize is that this person, and they were somebody who would often, you know, try to get this person to quit, try to fix them. But then at the same time would also like go buy their alcohol or save them from the latest disaster that their addiction had created. You know, they'd give them money, make a house payment for them, you know, whatever. And so as people observed that, professional folks observed that, they created this term codependency. So that just as the person who is dependent on alcohol was the dependent person, this mm-hmm. other person was codependent. They were also dependent on alcohol, or at least the process of alcoholism, as a way of organizing their lives, right? Because this was a prominent feature of their life. So then as time went on, you know, folks have looked at this term and have realized that in many ways, this term can be used much more widely than in the addiction world to really define anybody that is dependent or connected to a very unhealthy pattern and habit. And so, you know, I've been thinking about this a lot with the pandemic, specifically in regard to the medical world. And, you know, we've seen over time, as the pandemic has gone on, that there have been these different sort of pleas or attempts at explanation regarding the pandemic that, you know, one of the reasons that we're trying, well, we're not, but in theory, we're trying to get rid of the pandemic, is that we don't want our hospital systems to be overwhelmed. And we don't want, you know, we don't want there to be no hospital beds. We're realizing the incredible stress that this puts on our hospital workers. And, you know, we don't want that. That's bad. Now, of course, meanwhile, the hospital workers have kept doing their hospital work and kept doing their thing. And recently, as the pandemic is now totally out of control, it's always been fairly out of control, and now it's totally out of control. You know, you now have this phenomenon of doctors, nurses, both individuals, professional associations, heads of hospitals, hospital associations, literally begging the public, right? Yeah. Getting like, please, you know,
literally
please,
begging,
like literally begging, you know, we beg you to pay attention to the pandemic. You know, this one guy in Houston, the head of this huge hospital system down there, you know, did this whole video. My nurses are crying every day. You know, I've opened two new wings for the ICUs. You know, please wear a mask, right? Begging, begging. And basically, you know, the American denial zombies are like, fuck you. No, we're not going to do anything. And yet, of course, when these same people get sick, they want to get carted to the hospital and get taken care of. Right? And it's been really striking me that this is, in many ways, very emblematic of a codependence that is rife within our culture. And, you know, I've been wondering a lot why hospitals aren't just shutting down, having a national strike, basically just being like, no, we're not going to take care of you. Fine. You want to pretend this doesn't exist. You want to not wear a mask. You want to do whatever the hell you want to do. Great. And then when you get COVID, you can go home and die on your own. And Trump, of course, is the best example of this, right? I mean, he has created, in many ways, this catastrophe, totally denying that this thing existed. But then when he got COVID, and given the treatments that he was given, I feel pretty confident in saying that he probably would have died if he'd been left alone. But then when he got sick, you know, he wants the world-class treatment. And gets a level of treatment that, you know, nobody in America has access to.
Fun stuff. The, just, you know, I try to not have vindictive thoughts. So the other day we were driving and I had to stop at a gas station, and on the outside of the gas station, they had a sign saying, hey, we're required by law, blah, 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 to have masks. But if you don't have a mask in here, we'll assume it's because you have a medical condition. So we walk in and no one has a mask on. No one working there has a mask on. And in that moment, my thought was like, I hope the vaccine comes and these people don't take it. Now, I know that there's people that get hurt by not, like, it's people who can't take vaccines who will be casualties in this if people don't. So I want everyone to take it. But part of me was like, it would be great if they don't take it and a lot of them die. Like, that thought popped into my head because of just how disgusting it is for them to want to play it their way and always use things for their advantage, which is what abusers do. Like, Abusers, when they think they're going to lose something, they'll go crying, saying, I'll be better this time. Like, they do all the things. And so this is the relationship we have, not just with this. You know, we can see this with the progressive, different voter blocs' relationships with the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I was saying this example before we started, but so Chuck Schumer is saying, hey, Biden, you need to promise to do an executive order for $50,000 of student debt. Biden instead is saying, hey, we should have 10,000 right away and, you know, Congress should do it. So he's not setting a bold direction. If you criticize him for that right now, people, even many people who consider themselves very progressive, will jump on you because they feel that, you know, now's the time we need to support him. We can't criticize him because this is better than Trump, or this is the time we need to support him. These sorts of ways of thinking are what people do when they're afraid. Like, if you've experienced any kind of trauma or abuse, you might know what it's like to not want to say something that's going to upset your parent so you don't get hit. And so if your brother says something like a little bit too pushy, you're like, don't say that because we don't want to get hit. That's what it's like. That's kind of what a lot of codependency relationships and families look like, trying to just perform really well to avoid bad things from happening. And this happens at all levels. It's not just petulant, no maskers. It's any of us who are willing to stop fighting for something because we're afraid of a worse thing happening. And so we have to be the ones who go high when they go low. Like, we have to always perform and be the good people. We see this built into the fabric of so much in our society.
Yeah. And so, I mean, that fear mechanism that you're talking about is one thing. Then the other thing that the codependent system does for the codependent person to keep them roped in is guilt, right? So that's the other big emotion, you know, and this is the thing in healthcare workers, for example. You know, if you suggest to a healthcare worker that they not take care of somebody, they feel horribly guilty. Right. And they just have the sense of like, oh, my gosh, I can't do that. You know, my patients, you know, this poor person is sick. You know, I have to do that. I have. And part of what that is this systemic, and it starts in the family system, but then works out to other systems that we're involved with. It's this systemic emotional tie that keeps the codependent person coming back for more.
Yeah.
Right. And it keeps them roped in to that codependent behavior because they just feel really bad for that other person.
Right? And the same used against teachers are shamed when they want to go on strike for the same things. And, you know, exactly. I'm biased, but one of the most codependent relationships I've ever seen and experienced personally is a relationship between a pastor and a church that's struggling. Right. It's just to connect this to the spiritual dots. So many pastors are encouraged and expected to always be on the edge of burnout in order to keep the church going. I mean, I went bankrupt trying to keep my church going. So, like, it happens. So, and oftentimes it taps into this thing, like, we confuse it with service.
Right.
So, like, there becomes a thing where I have to give of myself more than I really ought to give. And if I don't, it's because I'm not a good enough person. So this is what people in different service kind of industries struggle with all the time, because we're told the ultimate good is like the soldier who lays down his life, you know, that kind of thing. And so we're told we have to, anything worth doing is worth dying for. And so we see that play in it too. And that level or type of codependency, or the way it's expressed, is often finds its roots within a really messed up version of Christianity that we've been taught.
No.
Like, that's the taking up the cross.
Yes. Yes. The codependent version of that theology. Yes. all right. We got a few comments coming in. Please comment away. Series.
I don't know what SAG signs are.
Sagittarius. So this is Sagittarius right now.
Okay.
Of Sagittarians.
I don't know enough about astrology and star signs to know the significance of that. So if you want to explain a little bit more, that'd be helpful, or somebody can explain. I've never heard it be explained before. Thanks, Michael. I'm assuming she's referring to you and your explanation of
Yes. Yeah, so I think so. Daniel, but that's cool. I can't remember my own name most of the time.
You totally look like you could be a Michael. I'm just gonna say that.
Okay. Just
take that for what's worth. my freedoms. I don't ever know how to articulate the modulating lowercase capital.
Right.
Connie writes, people are saying that they are not going to have their lives affected by this virus and they can do what they want, but they are hurting others and they don't care.
Right. Yeah, no, exactly. And so, you know, again, this is the basic dependent or, you know, in this model, addictive stance, right? I'm going to drink. I don't care what it does to anybody else. Right. I'm going to do whatever. I'm going to get sick. I don't care what it does to anybody else. That's the basic self-centered, narcissistic, juvenile approach to life. But then the codependent person, rather than setting a boundary on that, just allows and in fact even encourages it, all in the name of trying to be helpful, even if in fact they're not being helpful really at all. All they're doing is perpetuating the habit.
And this is one of the things I've seen people talk about is, and we've seen this for 4 years, and so you think people know better, that somehow people believe that these chickens will all come home to roost. That because they're being careless about it, that they will suffer, and then they'll learn their lesson. No, that's, you don't have to expect it at all, because we do know that they're aware that maybe old people die because of this, and they're like, well, they're old anyway, right?
Yeah.
And if they get sick, they're more likely than not to recover. And if someone dies from it, they can always switch, pivot to merit and say, well, they maybe did something stupid, or they would have died anyway, or the flu could have done that. So everything is plausible to them that they can deny. And so there's no real sense of consequences for their actions. Like, they're buffered from it. So this is the thing about boundaries. Like, we can't expect the virus to set the boundaries for us, which is also part of the logic that people are using.
Yeah,
we have to be willing to set boundaries that are like have integrity and stop enabling the vast array of injustices we see in our society. Kathleen writes, I wonder if some of us are being codependent when we lift up the healthcare workers as heroes.
Yeah. I mean, definitely. And people have talked about, we've seen that not just healthcare workers, but also essential workers, right? Like, you guys are heroes. You guys are awesome. And then when they say, great, pay us a living wage. And then suddenly we're like, oh no, we can't do that. But you guys are heroes. You know? Yeah. That's a totally codependent. That's part of the system. You know, the codependent person gets a lot of perks for being codependent, right? They get told they're so caring. They're so loving. You know, they're so wonderful. Oh, you know, you're this long suffering person. Isn't that great? You know, you put up with all of this and you still had a smile on your face and a song in your heart. There's all these kinds of things that keep the entire system locked in.
It's a good sign of people who are being taken advantage of and taken for granted if they're given non-material kudos. So it's why there's Pastors Appreciation Month. Yes, I know there are crap pastors who get overpaid, but most pastors are underpaid. It's why there's a Secretary's Day. It's not because people really love secretaries all that much. It's because they know they should get paid more, but they don't want to pay them. So they're going to do this other thing instead. We see this a lot in our society. And that's a good example of what Dan's talking about, the sort of codependent enabling of enablement that we see. Susan writes, that's an honest confession of dark thoughts. I can't say I never have them, but I refuse to let them rule my head and heart. I'm assuming you're talking about me thinking for a split second that it'd be cool if they all died of the COVID. Thinking that's how God operates and so should I, be vengeful and punitive is something I can't do, but I'm so angry at anti-maskers.
Yeah. See, and one of the things I'd like to suggest is that, those thoughts, I don't think are dark thoughts. I would say that one of the the most challenging tasks of the spiritual life is to allow other people to experience the results of their own karma. Right? To allow other people to experience the results of their karma. And that's not a dark thought. That's actually being a very kind of healthy, differentiated person. And, you know, you can feel sad that they're caught in that karma. You can feel sad that they're so lost and confused. You can certainly offer them alternative ideas, right? I mean, it's not like anybody's kept secret the ways that we could help this pandemic. I mean, my God, like the information's out there, right? You can pay attention to it. But if you don't, it's very healthy to say, well, yeah, you're going to experience a result of your own karma. And that's hard, but it's better for everyone involved.
And there's a fine line there. Like, I think this is an area for people to maybe use it as a starting point for discernment. Like, personally, I think vengeance, like that thought I had in my mind, you know, I always think almost any thought I have, it's not like there's a single motive per thought. It's usually a complex web. So was there some vengeful thinking in there? Like, I hope they suffer. Maybe. Was it just like, oh, I want them to learn their lesson? Maybe. I don't know all the depths of it. And so it's interesting to discern that. And part of the thing about contemplative practice is to look at your thoughts and feelings without judging them right away. You can discern and judge them a little bit later, but right now you should just notice them and let them sit and then ask questions about them out of curiosity. And so in that moment, when I had that thought, I started thinking about, like, where is this coming from? And it's because I was angry at them just flaunting this, and that this is part of a larger system of people exploiting the hell out of the environment and other people and taking it all for granted. So at some point, when that there's enough tension in those moments, violence erupts. I mean, this is where revolutions come from. So I want them to learn their lesson the easy way instead of the hard way.
All right, the comments are pouring in now, so we got a...
Sarah's writes, if hospitals go on strike, the right wing will definitely weaponize the strike situation as a tool to support that the belief that science and healthcare is corrupted and cruel. You're right. Even though the right wing never cared about dismantling the medical industrial complex.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that might be true. And that's the risk that people are get scared of. And oftentimes when you set boundaries, the dependent person reacts very negatively. And, you know, that's a challenge. You have to be willing to work with that.
Catherine writes, so there's a lot of irony in our society. Oops, sorry, glove hands. You and your glove hands. Irony, our society blames a lot of people for suffering they did not choose and refuse to help. Treatment, for example, suffering due to fat phobia, transphobia, or ableism in the medical system.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Susan writes, a theology of accountability and justice in this context. Help me understand this rightly.
Yeah, well, that's what I was just talking about in terms of the karmic piece. You know, is that accountability and justice basically says, yeah, you are responsible for the outcome of your actions. And we are going to give you space to experience that. And we're not going to try to rescue you from yourself. So we will stand beside you. We will, you know, try to be kind and compassionate. We'll certainly give you the teaching, the information that you need to be more healthy. But we are not going to enter into your space of unhealth and allow that to consume both of us under some pretext that is valuable and helpful.
Yeah,
you know, God is not codependent. I mean, that's what I talk about all the time, right? That's one of the things that drives us. God is not codependent. We see that over and over again in the biblical witness, but we have a hard time acknowledging that.
And there are different narratives in the scriptures, and you can definitely see examples. You could build a case that God is vengeful and spiteful, blah, blah, blah. But usually what we see, and I think it's worth weeding out these narratives and seeing where they're coming from, but usually what you see is God saying, well, judgment is like God withdrawing a certain amount of blessing or protection and letting things happen. So giving over nations. I mean, you even see this in the New Testament, where if you have a member in your midst who's doing these misdeeds and is bringing harm to the community, that you hand them over to Satan. And what that usually means is like withdraw the protection that the community brings them and let them go where they're going to go, and have all the consequences of that. And so it's helpful to at least reframe the way we think about judgment in those terms of just not allowing the community or the witness to come to such harm. And so you withdraw the protection and the support so that they can experience the depth of their actions. And that's hard. I've always sucked at that part, doing the hospitality thing for a long time, because I always felt motivated by guilt. What if this person I turn away because they're being abusive dies on the streets? Mm-hmm. So it's not an easy thing, but that's what it looks like. Kathleen writes, I felt that I was being held hostage by a church where many refused to wear masks. I refused to lead any more in-person services there. Of course, it helped that I was financially able to walk away. It isn't that easy for most pastors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there are all kinds of things that keep us in the codependent relationship, and certainly finances can be one of them. But what's interesting, of course, is the number of people who could do what you did and walk away and don't. So that's actually far more than the number of people who truly cannot walk away for one reason or another.
Susan writes, it blows my mind. The beliefs are so twisted. There's a lot of twisted thinking out there right now, and it's discouraging because sometimes you get into thinking that people, if they can be given the right information, will make the rational choice. And we often underestimate the power of ideology and myths that have over people's minds. It's one of the great blind spots, for lack of a better term, that liberals in our society have, is we believe that education cures all ills. And what we mean by education is this very thin sort of information banking way of doing education that really lacks the power to transform. So we really need to challenge ourselves by asking, what does transformation look like? Yes. And not to settle for like, well, here's a PowerPoint presentation about the pandemic. Shen writes, this is something that isn't discussed enough, that people with codependent tendencies and patterns actually co-create disempowering relationships and environments in the name of being empathetic or the bigger person. It is insidious.
Yeah, and that also, that codependence is in itself a form of addiction, right? And I mean, you also see this all the time in all kinds of discussions about heterosexual relationships, right? That, you know, you've got, you know, these horribly abusive men who are obviously doing terrible things to women. And, you know, it's quite common knowledge in popular culture that oftentimes those guys are the most attractive to women. And what, you know, what is that about? Well, again, that's this training, this formational training in a patriarchal system that, you know, women get trained that they should be, that these guys are attractive, right? And so there is all sorts of ways that people are get involved in this. And yeah, and it is something I think, I agree with you, Shen. It's not discussed enough. It's not looked at enough. And it is fascinating how you see how powerful and hard this is, because when you do start talking to people who are in that codependent position about not being there, it's terrifying because you see how much it occupies their life space and energy. And they're like, well, what would I then do if I'm on my own, if I'm not involved in propping this all up. It really is a part of their entire world and identity.
Sarah's continuing the thought about the right-wing dismantling healthcare or mediocre for-profit model of healthcare. We don't want to pay essential labor or give them appropriate level of authority. That's right. Thomas raises a provocative question. Are classes codependent, rich and poor?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is the argument leftists often have around unions and stuff, because I think poor, I don't want to victim blame at all, but there's a sense in which we've gotten so caught up in lifting up the capitalist narrative that working class people and lower income people enable a system. Because, and this is what we see now, like where you're, and it's understandable. I was just listening to a little radio documentary about Eugene Debs, and there was a huge strike, the railroad worker strike, 250,000 mm-hmm. people in the union, and very successful, but then Grover Cleveland brought in the military to crush it, right? And so then after that, like, you had fear, like, that was one of the breaking points of the union movement. People were afraid, like, we can't stand up for what we want or something bad could happen. And so that mentality still persists among people wanting to form unions. And there's a way in which it's understandable, totally, but there's also a way in which it's a codependent way of relating with bosses and the owner class.
Mm-hmm. Yep. All right. So we're over time. We'll zip through these.
We got about five or six left. Catherine writes, see also irony. Conservatives, people thinking that unwanted or dangerous pregnancy is karma for sex, and so abortion should be illegal. I'm really uncomfortable with this kind of thinking because of how abusive that conservative rhetoric is, which tends to put dire consequences on the wrong people. That's right. There's definitely this weird merit sort of way of thinking about things that is twisted by all sorts of pathological logic. So I think the idea, think about the cause and effect of consequences of actions, does need to be interrogated. Yeah.
Well, yeah, and see, that's an example that is a very twisted version of what I was talking about, because there, what you're trying to do is you're trying to prevent people from making a decision. Which is different than allowing them to make their own decision. And then, you know, they have to work with that. Anyway, we could have time to dice that out more, but I appreciate that particular example.
You know, it could easily slip into poor people are struggling with their own choices, but that only works if you ignore the vast totality of how capitalist society works. So because of thinking works, if you had an extreme myopic way of looking at reality, which is what they do. Thomas says the maskless are so screwed economically that they don't want their liberty impinged upon it in one more way. Not all, I've met a lot of
some of them, but yeah,
for sure. Like, you know, the stereotypical working class rural person who's a Trump supporter that applies to, it's ideologically driven more than economically driven, although economics ties into the ideology. Connie writes, my sister and brother-in-law both have COVID but are at home. Sorry to hear that. They are pastors and allowed their congregations to decide whether to wear masks or not. Oh boy. They decided not to wear masks. Two members of the congregation have died from COVID. They did not lead. They succumbed. That's a tragic story. A particularly tragic example of a pattern that's a lot larger than that. It's discouraging. Thomas writes, doesn't the divine light shine equally on the just and unjust? Yeah, but not everyone can see the divine light the same.
Right. That's how that works. It's shining, but you may not be noticing.
It's very easy to take that logic beyond what it's meant to state, the rain falling on the just and unjust, and use it to say, to enable codependent thinking. So anyways, Kathleen writes, I keep hearing that children are suffering from not being in classrooms. My son is really suffering a lot. I think our educational system is so messed up that having the whole thing disrupted is a good thing. And that's a whole other. We should have a conversation about education again sometime. We did it way back towards the beginning. Julie writes, how to know if you're codependent on your deathbed, other people's lives flash before your eyes. Oh, God.
That's a great test.
I'd rather find out before I was dying.
Yeah, I was going to say, so, if you got to wait till the end of the test. Oh, that's good.
Ceres writes, codependency is another form of the savior scapegoat complex. It clouds our ability to know what actual natural dependency and interrelations look like to not get caught up in forced intimacy and codependency.
Mm, absolutely. It's great.
Gus writes, company pizza party is a great great example of the bees are being nice. The owner class knows exactly what they're doing, and so should we. But we're family.
That's right.
Whenever your boss calls you family, and they are
run,
and they're making a lot of money and you're not, then run. Susan writes, yes, the conservatives have learned how to use this thinking to their advantage.
Yeah.
I mean, and this.
Yeah. And so that's the thing. I mean, kind of just to close out and Catherine's example, I think it's a great one. So you have to look at the nature of the relationship and is there oppression and coercion involved? Because that is going to sort of skew all of this analysis. And so when I'm talking about allowing people to experience a result of their karma, I'm talking about that in a non-coercive and oppressive environment. Now, when you're in a coercive and oppressive environment, that is the thing that comes to the fore and is something that has to be looked at and dealt with very clearly. It's very easy to twist all of this stuff, just like it's very easy to twist the theology of the cross into something that's very oppressive and abusive. And so this is one of the reasons that having a deeper analysis of all of this is really helpful.
Final word from Julia, a joy to bring laughter to your day.
Thank you, Julia. And I hope that our lives do not flash before your eyes when you're on your deathbed.
Amen.
But if they do, I hope that we're laughing. All right. Great to see everybody.
We'll see you tomorrow.
Yep. Bye.